So what we're discovering is there are certain automobiles that are very sensitive to this. Subaru is one of them. Eric, what's the brand name of your electronic vehicle that we know is also very sensitive to HF? Over to you, Eric.
Yeah, well, it was Ford's first experiment in hybrids, and it actually went through a lot of effort to do a lot of shielding because there's 19 computers in there, and they do make a racket, and they try and keep it within .15 with a bit of a task for them. The newer vehicles are a little bit better, but they're not making cars anymore, they're just making trucks, so. And a lot of the trucks are designed to have two-way radios in them, and they take a completely different approach of how to control things in the car, and they tend not to use some of the fancy buses because it's just susceptible to even 5 watts at HF. Because of all of the advertisements that are required to give them a favorable cash flow, I'm pretty sure QST ARRL would not be able to do what I'm about to suggest. It sure would be nice if ARRL headquarters did a bunch of surveys, polling amateurs, doing experiments in their laboratory to find out which automobiles people are likely to buy, hams are likely to buy, are very sensitive, and which ones are not very sensitive. It sure would be nice to have a list of vehicles that are known to be compatible with HF installations and the ones that are known to be very non-compatible. ARRL, because of all their advertisers and all the flack they would get, they cannot do that. We amateurs can. We amateurs can. So, as our own private group, if somebody gets smart enough, we can start gathering this information. This is the kind of information that you would keep your ear very close to the ground, Eric. So, Eric, from your experience and from all the friends you've talked to, know of certain vehicles like Subaru and like your original Ford electronic vehicle, you know are very sensitive. Do you know of others that are very sensitive? And conversely, do you know of any brands of modern-day automobiles which are not so sensitive, where without a whole lot of grief you can put an HF installation into an automobile? KE2EJ for any of that info if you've got it. K2RIW in the TechNet.
2RIW, KE2EJ. Well, there's a couple of different vehicles that are pretty much okay to put high-power transmitters in, as long as you put the antennas in the appropriate places. The Ford series of trucks, you know, the F-Line, the Chevrolet series of big trucks, those are okay. They're all designed to be able to take some RF. Although the Chevys, from what I understand, are not that terribly quiet, and what a lot of guys I hear are doing is they use a separate power supply for a constant voltage power supply, which is a switching supply. It keeps all the line, you know, all the switching noise out of the DC supply that makes it into the radio. I don't know about Chrysler products, but as a general rule, the Japanese, forget it. They do such a lousy job, and they don't really look at part 15. They go by the Japanese radio of Ofcom and stick to those rules, which are quite a bit more forgiving than what we have here.
Part of what you just said, Eric, gave me a hint. If we ran our separate electronic transmitting equipment in our automobile from a completely separate battery that wasn't the same battery that's running the electronics of the car itself, I'll bet you that would give you a hell of a lot more immunity. Now, how are you going to keep that battery charged? That's another whole issue. Maybe you flip a switch when the radio is not being used, and the two batteries put in parallel, and your alternator is charging your auxiliary battery. But if an auxiliary separate battery was being used to run the electronics of the ham radio equipment, and particularly if that battery didn't go through the firewall, if your electronics is in the passenger compartment, and the battery, maybe it's a fancy NiCad battery, a fancy lithium-ion battery, is in the automobile with you. And then that goes to an antenna on the rear of the car with a well-shielded coax cable. I'll bet you that could be a hell of a lot more less vulnerable. What do you think, Eric? KE2EJ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
All the guys that I know that do it, they're using sealed lead acid batteries, actually marine batteries. They, you know, they mount them in the, not in the cab of the truck, but in the back pan of the truck, you know, like a pickup. And to charge it, they have a charge controller, which you feed in 12 volts from the car, and it actually makes the appropriate voltage for the state of charge that the battery you're charging is in. So it gives you complete isolation between the car's electrical system and what you're using the car to radio with. Also, lengths of cable seem to, for some guys, seem to be somewhat critical. The longer they make it, the more the voltage drop, but the more it spews out all that RF and affects their receiving.
Okay, I missed the first couple of words, Eric. So are you saying that there are guys with pickup trucks that put all the radio equipment in the back of the pickup truck with this fancy charger that charges that battery, and that now avoids an awful lot of these incompatibility problems between the ham electronics and the electronics of the vehicle? Over to you, Eric. Who did you say is doing that? And are there articles describing the guys who are doing this and how they do it? KE2EJ, K2RIW, and the TechNet.
K6DBZ with a comment.
As far as I know, there has not been anybody writing about this stuff. The guys that I know have gone through a number of experiments. A bunch of guys down in Florida, about a couple blocks from the house that I have down there. We tried a bunch of things. I suggested that they try the separated DC route. Actually, you can put a scope on the, or an egg spectrum analyzer right by the vehicle and literally do some pickup by the DC lines, and you see all the switching noises. There's always really rotten square waves. They're humming on there. They don't really care, because further away you get from the car battery, the more pronounced it seems to be. K2RW, K2J.
Eric?
Comment.
Eric, you said the Punter guys down in Florida. Does that mean there's a town in Florida called Punter, or the Punter group? What does Punter guys in Florida mean? Over to you, Eric. Wait for the beeps.
A6DPZ. I said a bunch of guys. There's a few hams down there, but there are a lot of actually HF guys. And there's a few guys that are really into it, so, you know, we're all friends.
So as you
comment, a technical comment, a very nice.
So as you guys
matter.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
So as you guys can tell, there's all kinds of ways by which you can get electronics to work in various automobiles. I didn't say it's easy, but don't give up. It's worth doing. But before you buy your next brand new automobile, I guess what we've all got to do is check with all of our friends. This particular car that I'm about to buy, this brand name, this model number, do you know of people who have put electronics in ham radio transmitting equipment into it? Were they successful? So to check that ahead of time is a darn good thing to do, as I see it. Eventually, some enthusiastic amateur or amateur group is going to come up with a list of cars that are known to be vulnerable, a list of cars that are known to not be vulnerable, and a list of techniques that people have used to make it work. If HF radio is important to you and you want to be able to talk to your HF friends while driving, particularly on the vacation trips, for instance, when you're spending a lot of hours in the car, and this is something that is certainly worth seeking. Let me drop it. I have used 2-meter equipment for my automobile while taking long trips through all places like Virginia, Tennessee, Arkansas, Missouri, Ohio. And by listening to their local repeaters, to listen to their local accent, to listen to their idioms they use, I can remember while driving through the middle of Tennessee, where there's a number of amateurs in Tennessee that don't use a telephone, they use ham radio equipment to talk to each other. And boy, do they have funny expressions as to vocabulary that they use.
Repeater, timeout.
I do remember their very peculiar accents and very peculiar expressions that they use with each other.
My wife, who comes from the Midwest, knew some of those words and was able to translate for me. So there's all kinds of English that's used in the mountainous regions of the center of the United States. Okay, I think we've gone down the list of everybody who signed in who did have a question or a comment. At this time, we're about to go over to Roy, AC2 GS, with the science talk portion of the equipment, of the TechNet. So, Roy, AC2GS, give us a brief transmission. Let's make sure everything's working well. K2RIW and TechNet. You've got it, Roy.
One last comment, take on mobile, HF mobile.
Go right ahead, Rich.
Okay, this is N2EO. Yes. The last car I owned was a 2001 Toyota Corolla. I know it's going back a ways, but I think in that car probably not a lot of electronics like today. But the 2001 Corolla gave me milkweed. I didn't even know it existed. 100 watts into an antenna tuner in the trunk, made by ICOM, and I had ham sticks on the driver's side quarter panel. I used ham sticks at 40, 80 meters, a little 20, and to bring them down in the area I really wanted to operate, I used a tuner. I hit a button on an ICOM 7000, it came right down. Back to you, Dick. N2EO.
Comment, N1YDY.
That's interesting information. Thank you, Rich. YDY, go right ahead.
Yeah, where do you suggest we send a list of vehicles with which we are familiar?
To a place on in the Port Washington area of Long Island. We're going to have our own list, as I see it. All of a sudden, I've forgotten your name. YDY. We're going to have to do this ourselves. I know that ARRL feels as much too much vulnerability, too much liability. They will not keep track of that list. But we radio amateurs are going to have to form a website. And maybe Roy's going to volunteer to do this. When we get to Roy, I bet you he'll volunteer to do this, to gather a list of equipment that we know is vulnerable. Apparently, a 2001 is what Rich just told us about his vehicle. So, do you happen to have equipment, vehicles that you know of that were vulnerable, not very vulnerable? Mr. YDY, K2RIW, go ahead.
Yeah, Rich, name is Hank, as I'm sure you remember. I know that a 98 Jeep Grand Cherokee seems to work very well no matter what power I run through it. I've run 205 or so. I had one of those Kenwoods at 200 watts, and it didn't seem to notice it. And I have some experience with four different Mercedes diesels, and two of them were completely immune. One was bothered. It's the idle of the vehicle, and the last one was absolutely horrible. So I'd like to contribute that specifics of that to whomever is going to keep a list.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Hank. And please forgive me, I'm so darn forgetful on people's names. That's why I keep asking everybody to give me their name when they sign in. Okay, so you've gathered some information. Roy's going to be gathering information, is my guess. You wait and see. AC2GS and the Science Talk, K2RIW. Go right ahead, Roy.
Okay, good evening, Dick. How are you hearing me tonight?
You sound beautiful so far. And by way of the email you and I had with each other, I've still got a guess that your switching power supply was one of the factors. And we'll keep an eye on the fact that there's two different kinds of dropouts, as you know. A long and a short dropout, as I call it, and you guys with earlier experiments were lumping that all together and not recognizing the difference. AC2GS and Science Talk, K2RIW and the TechNet.
Okay, very good, Dick. Well, you'll listen to my signal, and then at some point you'll tell me, give me a guess of what configuration you think I've chosen for myself tonight. So this is Alpha Charlie 2 Golf Sierra, and I want to repeat what I usually repeat. We have some information to give everyone. If you want to ask a question, suggest a topic, make a statement, refute me, what have you, if you want to give me a list of cars and do at HF and VHF and UHF, send it to me, and I'll see if I can thing into it, because I maintain something else called the Hitchhiker's Guide to Repeaters, so I can just as well have the Hitchhiker's Guide to Automobile HF Interactions. Let me drop.
There were two relatively long dropouts that time. I am guessing you might be using the switching power supply. Roy, go ahead.
Okay, yes, I was using the switching power supply, so purely on battery, so you can tell me if I drop out that I dropped out, and we'll be completely confused about it, although there might be something with my voice triggering the touch tone inhibitor, things like that. So we'll find out now. Right now, there's no switching power supply. There's not even a linear power supply. There's good old lithium iron phosphate battery in action. Let me drop.
That lithium iron phosphate battery, what's keeping it charged, and is it connected to anything that's charging it? Over to you, Roy.
It's usually part of a bypass system so that if the power supply gets disconnected or turned off, it switches over and feeds my radio the battery power. And what I've effectively done is pull the cord on the power supply that's connected to it. So there's no power supply connected to it. It's just feeding pure battery power.
Okay, on that last transmission, you had those long dropouts, two of them. Is it the flex radio you're using right now? Do you have the ability to use the 7100? Go ahead.
Yeah, I'm waiting for the beep. No, I'm using the 7100, so go figure. It happens with the flex. It happens with the 7100. It happens with different radios, with different antennas, with different microphones, with different push-to-talk buttons. Again, the only two commonalities is my location and my voice.
Really crazy. No dropouts on that last transmission. And by the way, the dropouts are we can easily put together with the human speech what you've said. So we're not really losing any concepts, just that it's quite a mystery, these dropouts. Please proceed, Roy. Even with the dropouts, you're fun to listen to.
A ghost in a ham shack.
Yes, we have a poet out there. Okay. Once again, if you want to contact me for whatever reason, it's mailbag@ac2gs.com. Again, mailbag@alphacharlie2golfsierra.com. If you want to look at any of the links for any of the material I'm talking about, I've opened up some new links. You go to the website roy.alphacharlie2golfsierra.com, and that's where you'll find all of my links. And finally, if you want to go into the chat room, we maintain a little chat room for the TechNet. You just go to chat.ac2gs.com, and that will land you in the chat room. So those are the things to remember, and I'll let it drop, and I'll go to my first item for the night.
WB2CUK with a quickie.
Okay, quickie away.
Hey, I just took my mic apart, and I want to find out if it may be having reports sent through in the swapping shop. This is Bill, WB2CUK. My audio is dropping out. How does the audio sound on the mic? And I can't add anything to your battery charging problem, other than you got to be careful with the lithium ion. So I guess if you give them too much of a charge, they'll go boom. Over to you.
You had a brief break, dropout on that last transmission, Bill. So you're saying you're experimenting with a microphone that was giving you some dropouts. CUK, go right ahead. K2RIW.
I can tell when I did that. I let go of the mic button. It's got a very loose mic button. I'm just worried about when the audio, when I'm talking, it's not breaking up. But that's the story. And how are you doing, Dick? I had a question on antennas, but I'll let you finish up with the battery discussion.
Well, we've for the time being, we've left the question and answer period of the TechNet. We're over to the science talk of Roy's right now. But I guess right after Roy finishes, maybe we'll come back to your question. AC2GS, please proceed. K2RIW.
I'm going to put it on the hospital. I'm not on the Glen Oaks. Let's see what happens to see if he gets any more dropouts. K2GS.
Good try, Eric.
Okay, very good. And to Bill, this is ion. It's an unfortunate phrasing problem. It's lithium iron phosphate. It's a slightly different battery technology than lithium ion or lithium polymer. It's less likely to go boom, thankfully. I've used it for a while. The specs are great for it. It allows you 3,000 recharge cycles. It discharges very, very slow. Most of your voltage for most of the life of the charge, and it's a very good battery, but it's $10 an amp hour, so it costs a little bit more than lead acid cells, but it's significantly technologically better. Let me drop. Okay, I don't want to turn this into a consumer report, but this past week a whole bunch of bleeding-edge technology products were announced. So I thought that I would touch upon some of them, drill down if anyone. So, the single-lens reflex camera was invented back in 1861. That was, of course, film-based. But fortunately for a film manufacturer, unfortunately, for film manufacturers like Eastman Kodak, nothing forever. The first digital single-lens reflex camera was manufactured in 1999, and film has become more of a novelty than the billion-dollar business that it was in the late 20th century. It would seem like the digital single-lens reflex cameras will have a longer lifespan, though, than their film-based ancestors. Companies like Fuji, Panasonic, and especially Sony have revolutionized photography with the introduction of very powerful, somewhat moderately priced so-called mirrorless cameras with interchangeable lenses. Rather than pentaprism and a flip-up mirror to obtain lens-eye views of the modern cameras simply scan the camera's CCD sensor and read the information plus a lot more into miniaturized LCDs or displays in the viewfinder as well as on the back to most cameras. Let me drop. At first, these types of cameras came with fixed lens with a single focal length. Then fixed lenses with a variable zoom focal length were introduced. But when interchangeable lens became available, the high end of photography was never the same again. At first, these cameras were meant for consumers and as little more than a toy for professionals, but as the feature set increased, they captured the hearts and minds of so-called prosumers and many photography professionals. One of the best examples of this kind of camera is Sony's Alpha 7 III line. It has gotten a lot of press, and it seems to be selling like hotcakes. Nikon and Canon have been manufacturers of professional photographic gear for more than half a century, and even they have been feeling the pressure. Both companies have planted numerous rumors that they were working on their own mirrorless cameras that would successfully compete with guys on the block. Let me drop.
I'm going to make a brief transition here. Eric, I'm with one earphone, I'm listening to Roy's direct RF output. With the other one, I'm listening to the output of the repeater. He does not drop on the input. I only hear the drop on the output. So something funny is going on, and the repeater itself, Eric, KE2EJ, K2RIW, the TechNet. Maybe Eric is busy. So please proceed, Roy. Roy, a mirrorless single-lens reflex camera. How in the world do they do that? Is there a 45-degree mirror in there that's half silvered? In which case, that could give you a 1 f-stop of decrease in light. Is that the way they're doing it with no floppy mirror? AC2GS, K2RIW.
No, Dick, there's no optics involved in this. It's a purely electronic viewfinder. Now that we have the technology, the CCD sensor that replaced the film stock sends live signals up to an electronic viewfinder above, and there's no need for any kind of optical doodads. There's no flipping mirrors. There's no pentaprisms. It's just a wire and an integrated circuit connecting all three of these things together. It's a brave new world.
I should have realized that. Well done. And when you're setting up a camera connected to, say, for instance, a telescope, because you're doing astronomical photography, being able to see with your viewfinder exactly what the electronics are seeing, boy, can that be handy. Because there are times when an astronomical view through a viewfinder and an astronomical view by the electronics could be quite different. Over to you, Roy, K2RIW.
And not only can you view what you would have normally viewed through a single lens reflex viewfinder, but because of the electronics, you could amp up the signal so that you can get an excellent image of the time delay. In other words, if you're going to keep your finger on the trigger for 2 seconds instead of 1/60th or less, it will actually just boost the signal. It'll introduce a background noise, but it's not permanent because you're just looking through the mirror, the viewfinder. But you'll be able to kind of get a much better idea of how the final image is going to look, even though it'll be visible seconds after you snap it. You know, we've gone a real far away from film. I used to love my film single lens reflexes, but these are just ridiculously advanced above that.
On top of that, there are some chunks of electronics on digital cameras which are very sensitive to infrared, particularly if you remove the infrared filter inside. And some of them are very sensitive to ultraviolet. So by looking at the electronic display, you can now see the infrared, the ultraviolet, and whatever. And my guess is even if you're using the time integration mode, you can see what's going on. So with astronomical photography, a mirrorless camera looks like the right way to go. I wonder if any of the astronomical magazines have mentioned any of these advantages so far. AC2GS, K2RIW.
Well, we'll have to ask Craig about that. I read a lot of magazines, but not astronomical ones. But, it's sort of amazing what this is capable of. The cameras that are sold to the general public have filters that filter out the ultraviolet and infrared. But there are specialty models where they remove those filters, and there are professional services that go into the lab and remove it that are not related to the company. So there are options, but they're in far less demand than the people who want to filter on the sensor so that they don't get ghost images from infrared or ultraviolet.
There was a whole lot of articles a few years ago about some of the popular Sony cameras. If you remove the infrared filter and or if you set it to the night vision mode while using it at high noon, it turns out that female nylon bathing suits, when they're wet, infrared-wise, become essentially transparent. And so there were groups of guys that were really having a lot of fun with their Sony cameras on beaches at high noon. Over to you, Roy, K2RIW.
Yeah, sometimes the less expensive models, they saved a few bucks by not including the filter because it costs something. But I think for the most part, especially these new professional versions, they all have filters along there. So I don't think that's quite as much of a problem as it once was. I've read those. So people have fascinating ways of getting around things, don't they?
But we amateurs are so, what's the word for it, straight arrows. We would never do things like that, Roy.
Absolutely positively. Boy Scouts, all of us. Let me move on to the rest of this, because Canon's camera model is still in the rumor phase, but just this week, Nikon announced their model Z6 and Z7 mirrorless cameras. Members of the Commonwealth call these things the Z6 and Z7, but for some odd reason, Nikon has gotten very fussy about it and said that it's only Z6 and Z7 worldwide. In addition, Nikon announced that they would be manufacturing a whole new collection of now called S lenses. Rather than using the old Nikon F mount lenses, and those were around for 60 odd years. So this is move for them. They haven't done anything with their mounts for 60 years, and now we have something called the... Now, the price and the feature set seem to be suspiciously similar to cameras, which probably was a conscious decision on their part, because they're the guys to go after right now. Optical science doesn't usually advance as quickly as microelectronics, so it'll be interesting to see how much camera technology advances in the years to come. Let me drop for any questions or comments. AC2GS. Okay, for any of you gamers out there, and I'm sure loads of you guys are gamers, one of the two video card manufacturers, NVIDIA, just announced their next generation of video cards, calling them the RTX series for their enhanced ray tracing capabilities. NVIDIA and AMD graphic cards are usually rated in what's called teraflops. Those are trillions of floating point math single precision operations per second. In the old days of personal computing, motherboards with dedicated math coprocessors whose specs are laughable compared to these present devices. NVIDIA has not released their new card specifications in terms of teraflops. They're really pushing the concept of ray tracing optimized capabilities of these new line of video cards. They quote them as 10 gigaray functions. Make of it what you can. In addition to being great at video images, the RTX series supposedly will be optimized to work as a neural network. So if you guys are interested in developing your own artificial intelligence devices, this might be the video board for you. Will this revolutionize game playing with more realistic ray tracing in real time, or will it fizzle as more of a marketing solution in search of a problem? Well, time will tell. Let me drop for any questions or comments. I guess no gamers out there. Last week, there was a lot of talk about drone technology on the net, and one of the manufacturers, DJI, based in China. Well, this week, DJI announced its latest new models, the Mavic 2 Pro and the Mavic 2 Zoom. They're priced at the, for this company's consumer products, around $1,500. Their claim to fame are said to include a high-resolution Hasselblad camera element for one model and a lower-resolution zoom lens camera for the other. Both will offer collision detection placed all around their bodies to lessen the risk of banging into obstacles in flight, faster speeds, lower noises, and farther wireless ranges. Let me drop for any questions.
This is KB2MAR. I think maybe the reason why you're dropping out, you're probably over-deviating. Over to you.
So you think I'm over-deviating on two different radios that are completely different models from different manufacturers?
On this particular radio, you dropped out quite a bit of times. Maybe if you backed off the mic a little bit, maybe don't crowd the mic as much. Let's see what Rich has to say. Go ahead, Richard.
Anyway, so I'll just move the mic away. We tried lowering the microphone volume, and that didn't seem to make any difference. My best guess is for some odd reason my voice imitates DTMF tones, and that might be going on, but we'll find out. Anyway, next. Logitech announced a vertical mouse, which can be described as a mouse on its side. This kind of mouse might help those computer users suffering from carpal tunnel syndrome. Here's a blast from the past. In 2006, Sony shut down its Aibo robotic dog division. Recently, Sony changed its mind and reactivated the division. At first, it was only for the Japanese market, but this week, Sony announced that they will be bringing Aibo back to the American stores for a paltry price of $2,799. So if you have $3,000 lying around and you're curious about the benefits of an albeit mechanical dog that has an off and a mute button, you now have the opportunity. Let me drop.
With that backed-off microphone, Roy, on that great big long transmission you just now made, not one single dropout.
may be a factor there.
Okay, we'll see how it goes. The problem is it's not a consistent thing. It doesn't happen exactly so many times per second, what have you. So we'll see. I tried it a little bit farther, and we'll see how it goes. Anyway, on to the next thing. What about those rascally tinkerers from Russia, you ask? Well, Russian weapons manufacturer Kalashnikov, makers of the fine AK-47, the rifle of choice for mass shooters with style, brings you two new product announcements. Their first announced product was their own personal take on the emerging electronic vehicle industry. They announced the Retro-Style CV-1, which will have a range of 217 miles and will be able to get from 0 to 62 miles per hour in 6 seconds. Its batteries are said to have a capacity of 90 kilowatt hours. It is described as visually very similar to something called the infamous Soviet-era Trabant car, but to me it looks like what would happen if you made it a Yugo with an Oldsmobile from the 1950s. At least it doesn't have any place to insert bullets. Let me drop.
Coming. Would you like to make a comment?
Yes, Wesley, comment away.
Okay, I didn't hear that. Okay, it's a model of Lada 1976. That's the body. The vehicle was not tested, was not shown running, and the information are not verifiable. So I would rather think about it as information without the merit. There is a technical show right now, and in front of that there is a robot that looks like from Star Wars. The only problem with that robot is that it doesn't move. It's 4.5-ton robot that doesn't move, and also made by Kalashnikov. Let me drop it. There was a number of complaints that a significant amount of money in millions of rubles, which is the Russian currency, was dedicated to those projects, both of them. And so far, it looks like there was an abuse with that quote. So this information is rather for curiosity of somebody who wants to listen to stories and to exchange.
Yes, Wes, this bit is meant very much tongue-in-cheek, and I'll continue with it, and it introduces the robot as well. And the bottom line is, I don't know what's going on with the Russians, but let me get to the second half of this little story. One second, let me drop. Okay, let's see. We mentioned that you can't insert bullets in the CV-1 car. For those that have to turn to Kalashnikov, for something with bullets, we have to turn to Kalashnikov's other product, which we mentioned, the Igorek, or Little Igor. It's supposedly a 13-foot, 4.5-ton manned robot designed, quote, for carrying out engineering and combat tasks. Now, I see one market flaw, which Wesley has mentioned in the present design. Igorek, in its present form, is completely immobile. You would need some other device to pick it up, take it to a location, plant it there, where it would then apparently only be able to lift and lower its two sidearms as required. Now, perhaps I'm missing something, but the announcement of Igorek has drawn more than a few snarky responses around the world. One fellow posted an image of a drunk man on all fours and labeled it a human version of the Igorek. Others responded to a video of dogs herding sheep in New Zealand with the suggestion that they will soon be replaced by Igorek robots, large, clunky, and immobile. It's sort of like the famous ED-209 robots from the movie RoboCop, but made out of Legos. Little wonder that Russia has half as many people as us, but has one-tenth our gross domestic product. Their GDP is less than Italy. They have a lower life expectancy than North Korea. A gas station with nukes. Let me drop for any questions or comments.
I can come in order. For you to understand the phenomenon of Russia is, if something is said, then there is a pride to prove it, at least show it. And there is a money that is being dedicated to that. And like everything else, a part of that money is actually going not where it's supposed to go. And that's the whole story. Igorek doesn't move, doesn't have a power supply, and doesn't have a door. It's a maquette, but it is claimed to be a robot. Igorek is welded to the steel plate of 26 millimeters thick, and sufficient enough for Igorek to stay still till the Igorek is not hooked. So there were a few guys, five guys, that were trying to at least move that Igorek. So it looks like when you just took it and it falls down, it wouldn't be able to stand up. So that's the comparison to Boston mechanic. Boston, oh gosh, I forgot it. Dr. Roy.
Okay, very good. Thank you, Wesley. And for anyone curious, there are images of both the Igorek and the CB-1 car, as ugly as I mentioned. You could view it and have your own opinion on roy.ac2gs.com. Right on that page, at the very top, I think, are the images of those atrocities. So just to show you that gone are the old days of the Cold War. We won it, guys. Now, you know, don't we get to win a prize or something? Anyway, let me drop and then I'll move on to my next subject.
One more time. Dr. Roy, do you know what's going on with that nuclear engine missile that dropped into the Arctic the ocean? Interesting. Forward.
No, I'm not aware. When did this happen?
About 2 weeks ago, Russian ships were trying to right after the launch. So there were four launches of that supposed to ever cruising missile that has enough power to never land. And the longest part was 38 minutes, and it went to Barents Sea. And right now, Russian army is trying to pick it up from the bottom of it and to exchange.
Well, I hope they don't break anything, because I don't really consider them to be subtle. They're kind of do things slapdash. So you can't really do things slapdash with missiles and such, especially nuclear powered. We've had previous unfortunate problems losing nuclear missiles. Even the United States had, I think, three or four nuclear missiles in a test plane that crashed decades ago and dropped their load around Spain. And, they did it on the sea, so they quietly cleaned up most of it. But these things happen, so it's not that surprising. It's a little surprising that someone actually let it out of the bag, though.
Well, this is much more serious. It is not known, but it is expected. Let me jump. The nuclear engine using that rocket that was supposed to be new weapon, Russian new order weapon that President Putin was talking about, is converting heat from radioactive material to thrust. So every foot it moves, it leaves radioactive cloud behind it. There are some speculation that they were using different kind of temperature conversion, but if that it is, then we're not dealing with a regular nuclear missile. We're dealing with a missile that was made to threat the West, and now it is at the Barents Sea.
Well, Well, it sounds like if that's the technology they're using, the first time that they would even experimentally test it, everything around Russia would glow in the dark. So it's one of those things. I mean, we really live in a global economy, in a global world. When the Chinese decided to kind of use refrigerant materials that bust up the ozone again, everyone was able to detect the ozone layer dissolving on top of Asia. So I don't think they can get away with that anymore, but I'll look further into it. But I don't know. The trouble is when you give a country that doesn't really have going on a lot of stockpiles of nuclear weapons, and they try and do something with it, unfortunately.
The U.S. technology is 1957, and it was stopped because it was found inefficient and was reincarnated because of Putin agenda. Think about it as a hot, extremely hot piece of a radioactive material, and trust built around that, trying to push the air and convert heat so the missile moves. Enter exchange.
Okay, Wes, sounds like one of the dumbest nuclear propulsion devices I've ever heard. It's kind of like the RTG from hell.
The U.S. to Wes?
Yes, Paul.
I'm missing what sea Wesley said it was in. What water is this thing in?
Barents Sea. That's what was told in the news. It's in the Arctic.
In the Arctic. The Bering Sea, is that what you're saying? Bering?
Barents Sea. I have to look at the map how to spell it.
Okay, that's probably what it is. Okay. Okay, back to your work.
Okay, very good, Wes. Thanks for the information. I went into it. It's just another reason to have a sleepless night. We live in very interesting times, unfortunately. Anyway, getting on. In a recent paper in the journal Plus One, German researchers asked 89 college students to team up with a tiny, bright-eyed robot called Neo to answer questions and complete menial tasks. It's a robot partnership worthy of a buddy comedy, but as is typical in experimental psychology, these tests were distractions from the real question under investigation. What happens when the humans had to turn the robot off? Let me drop. In 43 cases, as reported earlier this month, the robot protested, telling participants it was afraid of the dark and even begging, "No, please do not switch me off." As the researchers predicted, the participants struggled to switch the machine, which they had previously worked with as a partner, off. 30 of the humans took long on average to turn off the robots compared to the group whose robot said nothing at all, and 13 people refused outright to comply altogether, leaving Neo on. Apparently, people perceive robots to be somewhat alive, and shutting them down can create some serious moral quandaries. In 2007, in a similar experiment, a talking cat-like bot begged for its life, but all the participants were forced to turn the machine off by an observing scientist. In that study, 100% of the people eventually complied, but it wasn't easy. Relating to a robot as though it were truly alive means we therefore hesitate to switch it off. In particular, if this means that the robots could lose its memory or personality. Let me drop. Psychologists have been tinkering around under the hood of humanity's psyche to see what triggers our moral and ethical bowstrings. In 1960s, a Yale University psychologist devised a way to test the most pressing existential question of the era. Could obedience to authority be enough to persuade ostensibly good people to commit acts generally considered evil? The researcher, Stanley Milgram, invited study participants into the lab, assign them the role of teacher, and ask them to administer ever-increasing electric shocks to their students under the guise of studying, learning, and memory. As the shocks escalated, the students, secretly a member of the research team and safe from any real harm, begged to be freed and exhibited signs of pain and distress. Some of the participants refused to continue, but approximately 65% administered the most intense voltage anyway. This was actually parodied in the 1984 comedy Ghostbusters. Let me drop. Controversial since its conception, the procedure created extreme levels of nervous tension, Milgram wrote in his original 1963 study. Profuse sweating, trembling, stuttering were typical expressions of this emotional disturbance. One unexpected sign of tension yet to be explained was the regular occurrence of nervous laughter. Whether they quit early or made it to the finish line, participants were very riled. While we tend to approach robots as though they are like human, they experience similar signs of distress what Milgram observed decades ago. Researchers have identified a few complicating factors. Our decision to turn a pleading robot off may be influenced by the price point or quality of the robot, its sociability, a factor the recent German study manipulated, and even the machine's coloring, which may be perceived as race or ethnicity, shape our interactions with these machines of our creation. As authors of the Plus One paper succinctly put it, when people are interacting with these robots, they often behave as they're interacting with another person and apply a wide range of social rules mindlessly. Let me drop. These reactions may seem silly or inconsequential to us, but artificial intelligence researchers actually worry about the consequences of our defenses, our deference to these robots, especially as they move into our homes and even into public life. The robots of today have no intelligence that would justify keeping them switched on. The robots of today do not care, one of the researchers wrote. We need to respect our creations, but we also need to avoid being fooled by science fiction. Amazon Echo is not Westworld, the researcher remarked, and Neo isn't Blade Runner. Ultimately, the guilt we feel when shocking a fellow human is good, but when it comes to a robot, researchers say, feel free to shut it down. Strange how we feel more pity for walking, talking toasters than another human being, eh? Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS.
Roy, along similar lines, the Star Trek series, Star Trek The New Generation, has a entity on there called Data. Data is an artificial intelligence, a kind of a robot. And on one of those series, an outside agency was going to somehow obtain possession of Data, and because he was so effective in what he did, they wanted to take him apart and find out how it was done. And so the people who were very friendly with Data, of course, were objecting. They didn't want him taken apart. They considered him a real human being. And I wonder if you remember that series of Star Trek Next Generation. And after this, I've got an even wilder one to describe to you. Over to you, Roy, K2RIW.
Yes, Dick, I'm a big fan of all the Star Treks. Brent Spiner is an excellent actor, and he did an excellent job. Every version of Star Trek tends to have someone who's not quite human, who entails them finding their humanity. In the original Star Trek, it was Spock. In the Next Generation, it was Data. Deep Space Nine, it was Odo. And it just keeps going on and on. So, yeah, that was very good. Data was supposedly a one-time thing. The professor who built him on a lone planet did it without any kind of leaving any of the paperwork behind and just left him to be activated. And so Starfleet wanted to take him to the lab and disassemble him and figure out how he worked. And he objected, saying that he was alive just because he was made out of a positronic brain parts and such. He had the same right to freedom as any living sentient being. So that was a great episode. I enjoyed it immensely.
Do you also remember that Data had a brother, which I think was an earlier version, a less successful version, which didn't didn't have anywhere near as much morality. Do you remember that series, Roy? Go ahead.
Yeah, that was Lore. That was the previous the data would become. It included, I think, an emotion chip that got kind of twisted. And he was kind of the evil twin. Evil twins are very famous in Star Trek. They use them a lot. They used to use them on television in the 60s and 70s. Data also had a daughter. He came back from some kind of symposium about...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
...parts of himself into her, and so he had a daughter. He also had an older brother. I think he was designated before they used him in one of the movies. So for a single unique creature, there were a lot of them.
Now, Rod Serling had a series of sci-fis, which I think was called The Outer Limits or something like that. Or was it called... I can't think of what his science fiction series was called, but in one of them, there was a female robot, which apparently was anatomically rather well equipped. And now, if a man is dating that robot, you can ask all kinds of questions, like if the man is married and he's having an affair with that robot, should the wife consider that adultery? Really crazy questions you can have on this one. Who are you, Roy? K2LIW.
Yeah, Rod Serling did Twilight Zone. He wrote for it. He introduced a lot of them, always with a cigarette in his mouth. Not surprisingly, he died of lung cancer. And there was also the Outer Limits. I used to enjoy both of those. There are guys working, I think, of course, it has to be in California, a company called Real Dolls or something. They're trying to build animatronics into their models to produce that. And technology isn't quite up to it, but humanity is interesting, the way that they figure out how to monetize. I mean, if it wasn't probably for pornography, the Internet wouldn't be as active as it's become. So we're strange creatures, us human beings.
By the way, I think I've seen estimates of the total amount of material passed back and forth on the Internet. By far, the largest single subject is essentially pornography. Over to you, Roy.
Yep, human beings, you gotta love them.
WS2N.
Forbidden fruit is the most fun. Go ahead, Paul. I mean, yeah. You know who you are. WS2N, go ahead, Paul.
Yeah, going back into the late 60s, you had the movie 2001, Space Odyssey, and you had the HAL 9000 computer. And after he got out of hand, they wanted to shut him down, and he was like practically begging, you know, not Dave, what are you doing, Dave? You know, one of those deals, and he didn't want to be shut down. And there was a whole probably half hour dedicated just to the process of this guy shutting this computer down, and his mind starts going. He starts singing the original songs that he was taught when he was being built in Indiana. So that was a good show. That showed that this thing was very sentient. Back to you, Roy.
The computer sang Daisy, K2MU.
Yep. It did a very good job of singing Daisy. The latest issue of Scientific American has a significant number of articles about humanity. And one of the biggest questions is, what is consciousness? And we can all speculate that as our artificial intelligence machines get more and more intelligent, will they ever really have what we call consciousness? And as we cross that threshold and they become conscious, would you then be able to turn them off? Would your ethics allow you to turn them off? We can ask all kinds of questions on that. But how does a human brain achieve consciousness? I think that is one huge mystery, which can you make an artificial machine have consciousness? You got a guess on that one, Roy? AC2GS, K2LIW.
Yes, Eric?
Interestingly,
talking about is human, the way humans behave, going back to the steady obedience to authority, that was Stanley Milgram's doctoral thesis. As people got up to the last couple of switches, which said danger, danger, most of them, of course, would flip the switch, but the button, the guy in the booth would scream like he's dying. The interesting part about it is, after all was said and done, and weeks went by for a lot of these people, they actually turned around and sued the guy because they finally realized what they could have done.
Well, that's the problem with this type of experiment, and experiments quite like this aren't really done that much anymore. The reason why it dates back to the 60s is because everyone sued everyone else, and you got to be very, very, very cautious about what